This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We have Siri to write our emails, online calendars to coordinate our schedules, and GPS to find our way. And still, we make lists. Whether written or typed, lists are sometimes practical, sometimes aspirational, and if viewed by anyone else, always revealing. Sean Usher is fascinated by what these private fragments tell us about their makers. We spoke to him when his riveting collection, Letters of Note, was published. Now the author and curator is out with Lists of Note, an eclectic collection deserving of a wider audience. It's a coffee table style book with images of more than 100 lists, from the record of accused Salem witches dated 1692 to Marilyn Monroe's list of New Year's resolutions from 1955, with its heartbreaking conclusion, "Try to enjoy myself when I can. I'll be miserable enough as it is." When we reached Sean Usher, I asked him why we write lists.
You know, everyone's so busy these days that to make a list kind of makes my day easier. As soon as I get up in the morning, I make a list and it kind of sets me off for the day. If I didn't make lists, I'd be just a mess. Everything would be chaotic and I wouldn't get anything done. It just makes life a bit more manageable, I suppose. And we're kind of fearful of the unknown, human beings, and to kind of label things and put them into little groups and lists makes us feel kind of content. We're all critics, so we love to rank things. We, you know, best to worst, favorite to least favorite. There's so many reasons we write lists. And it's also something, I mean, this came about from when I was doing letters of notes. So I was searching through all these archives full of beautiful letters written by amazing people. I kept finding lists written by the same people, more often, in fact, than I was finding letters, because everyone writes lists. They're so functional, you know, even in the digital age. It's not like they're being replaced by digital lists. We still have to write these lists. And with letters, you're always expecting someone to be reading the letter, at least one more person, at least the recipient. But with lists, they're often very, very private. You know, they're meant to be read only by yourself. So it's a really insightful way to learn about history and people themselves.
Yeah, there is a sense that you're sort of spying on people's thought process in some kind of way. Where do you see that in these lists?
Oh, my goodness, there's so many. I love lists that kind of reveal a different side to someone, particularly famous people. A list reveals something amazing about them, or not so amazing, when it comes to Albert Einstein, who obviously is one of the cleverest people ever to have lived. But he wrote a list in 1914, at which point his marriage was failing. And he said to his wife, "I will only continue our marriage if you agree to this list of demands, this list of conditions." And she did. She agreed to it. And it's a really kind of oppressive, misogynistic list. Things like, "You'll make sure that my clothes and laundry are kept in good order. You'll make sure that I receive my meals regularly in my room. You will stop talking to me if I request it." Just this horrible, horrible list that really kind of showed me something I'd never previously known about Einstein. I love lists that kind of reveal that side of people.
"You will obey the following points in your relations with me. You will not expect any intimacy from me, nor will you approach me in any way." It was a real image buster for me. I mean, I have this very different picture of Albert Einstein. And similarly, a ledger of George Washington's slaves, you know, Ben Franklin's drinker's dictionary. These are things that sort of changed my images of these people.
I know, and but the George Washington list of slaves, I mean, it's not news to most people that he had slaves, but to see it written in list form, it suddenly kind of adds another dimension to the whole experience. It really kind of brings it home.
Well, also fascinating to me was that you see Kurt Cobain's list of things needed for the Smells Like Teen Spirit video, or Picasso's list of artists for the groundbreaking Armory show. You realize that great things often begin with lists.
That's right. Even the most mundane lists kind of build up into the most incredible moments. There's one, I don't know why I just thought of this one actually, but there's a list by Walt Disney.
Just as they were making 50 Dwarfs.
Yes, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. So it's adapted from the Brothers Grimm original story, in which the dwarves were nameless. So Walt Disney and his gang, his team, came up with this kind of long list of 50 potential names for the dwarves, most of which are horrendous. Like they sound really terrible. But it's only because we now know which ones were chosen. We're kind of used to them. But it's names like Helpful, Wistful, Puffy, Biggy Wiggy, Big O Ego, Sneezy Weezy. But I adore lists that kind of show you an alternative universe, you know, what could have been. Which brings to mind, actually, the there's a list by Selznick Pictures, which I think it was voted the most famous movie line in history. Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. The censors deemed that the word damn was too rude. So the producers of the film came up with these alternatives. So what is now, you know, this incredible movie moment. And some of them are really, really terrible. Like, as you go down the list, this is typewritten list. As you go down the list, they get worse and worse. So it starts off with, frankly, my dear, I don't care. Frankly, my dear, it leaves me cold. But then you get to the bottom and it's got things like, frankly, my dear, I've withdrawn from the battle. Frankly, my dear, the whole thing is a stench in my nostrils. And the last one is, frankly, my dear, it makes my gorge rise. You can tell they were really clutching at straws as they got to the bottom of the list. Thankfully for everyone, the censors kind of agreed to let them use the word damn. But you never know. Had they chosen, frankly, my dear, if I've withdrawn from the battle, you never know. They might have picked up that might still be the most famous line. You'll never know.
Or we never know what The Godfather would have been like had Sir Laurence Olivier been chosen instead of Marlon Brando to play Vito Corleone.
Exactly. So this is it was actually a handwritten list that I think it's kept Coppola's winery, his vineyard in the US, but I couldn't get hold of the original list because it's handwritten, and he's just to see his handwriting as well is amazing. So this was his kind of suggestions for all these different roles, and it's a kind of alternative universe, and it's great to see which ones he kind of ticked and he didn't tick. He's got people like Dustin Hoffman, what else, Jimmy Caan, as we now know he was chosen, Laurence Olivier as Don Corleone. It's got Marlon Brando there underlined. It's just absolutely fascinating.
The book is just unbelievably entertaining, but it is also sort of museum-like in some ways. There's an inventory of gifts given to Queen Elizabeth I, H.P. Lovecraft's weird ideas, Thomas Edison's lists of things doing and to be done that go on for pages and pages and pages. Why did you let them go? Were you determined to present the lists exactly as they were? Tell me about that decision.
Exactly. There's no way I could live with myself had I kind of edited these lists and cut them off at certain points, because the whole beauty of the lists is to produce them in their entirety. Otherwise, you're not producing the list at all, I think. This brings to mind Georges Perec, the French novelist, who was obsessed with lists. I mean, he lived his life by lists. I had so many to choose from his lists, but I chose what is called in the book Attempt at an Inventory. And the full title of it, according to Georges Perec, is Attempt at an Inventory of the Liquid and Solid Foodstuffs Ingurgitated by Me in the Course of the Year 1974. And it's literally just a huge, I mean, it spans I think it's about five pages, a huge list of all the things he digested. If you take it without context, it's very mundane and just means absolutely nothing. But I really kind of admire the fact that he kind of kept up with this game, and I for some reason I find it really quite beautiful, and it wouldn't have worked had I just kind of reproduced one paragraph. So it's very important to me to kind of reproduce every single list.
Some of them are really interesting historical documents as well. From the 19th century, reasons for admission to a West Virginia hospital for the insane. Some of the reasons, female disease, laziness, marriage of son, sunstroke, suppressed masturbation, vicious vices in early life. Where did you find this?
That was one of the easy ones, actually. I think it was... Where did I find that? I think I just found it online. It went viral online a couple of years ago, and I just couldn't believe my luck. This was just as I was searching for all these amazing lists, and that one cropped up on my, I think it was on my Twitter feed. So that was a very easy one. So I got in touch with the asylum, or what is now, it used to be an asylum anyway. I got in touch with the people who work there now, and they verified that it was authentic.
What is the oldest list that you found?
There's one from 1250 BC, which was found in the Valley of the Kings, where they made the pyramids. And it's a list of excuses that the workers gave for their absence. So it's basically like nothing's changed. Well, things have changed, actually, because there's things like, oh, he was ill. He was fixing a door at home, that kind of stuff. But then you'll get to one that says he was embalming his mother. He was wrapping up his dead sister. So it's the mundane mixed with what is now seems just absolutely, you know, mind boggling.
My guest is Sean Usher, founder and curator of Letters of Note and now Lists of Note. It's an archive of memorable lists made throughout history. It can be found online and now as a beautiful coffee table book. Sean, what was the most difficult list for you to get a hold of, or maybe the most surprising?
The one that kind of surprised me most was the there's a list called Integrated Bus Suggestions. And this it's never been really reproduced in full before, and it sits in the Martin Luther King archives. And this was written in 1956. It was written by Martin Luther King. And it's a list of advice, very practical advice, for black people who were getting back on the buses. This is when they were allowed to get back on the buses. It's things like, not all white people are opposed to integrated buses. Accept goodwill on the part of many. Do not deliberately sit by a white person unless there's no other seat. If cursed, do not curse back. If pushed, do not push back. If struck, do not strike back. But evidence love and goodwill at all times. It's just, I mean, there's like 17 different bits of advice in this amazing list, and I just, that really surprised me, the fact that it wasn't, you know, just everywhere. I couldn't believe it.
One of the things that I think struck me the most was these notes to self for personal conduct, you know, things that probably all of us have written at some point, but by Marilyn Monroe and by Sylvia Plath, by Johnny Cash. What gets revealed to you in reading a list like that?
It's people's kind of private moments. So, well, with the Johnny Cash one, in fact, the Johnny Cash list, which is the first one in the book, and this was a to-do list he wrote. This is the first one I found that made me think there was a future for this project, because I was just so utterly charmed by this kind of private moment where he's obviously having a joke. It's on a pre-printed sheet of kind of to-do list letterhead. At the top it's printed, things to do today. 1, not smoke. 2, kiss June. That was his wife. 3, not kiss anyone else. 4, cough. 5, pee. 6, eat. 7, not eat too much. 8, worry. 9, go see mama. 10, practice piano. And then at the bottom is printed notes, and he's written under that, don't write notes. I found it in an auction house. This list had been up for auction a few years ago. And I just continued to search through this auction house's archives, and I found all sorts of lists. I found a list written by JFK's secretary, Evelyn Lincoln. She was in the motorcade when JFK was shot dead. And on the flight back to the White House, she wrote out a list of suspects. So people she thought could have possibly murdered her boss just hours ago. It's absolutely incredible. It's worth reading.
Tell me about some of those, because it was stunning to me. I think Lyndon Johnson's name is just above the KKK, if I'm remembering correctly.
Exactly. So at the very top is Lyndon, then it's KKK, then Dixiecrats, Hoffa, Jimmy Hoffa, John Birch Society, Nixon, Diem, which is the South Vietnamese leader, whose name I will not try and pronounce, rightist, CIA in Cuban fiasco, and then at the bottom it says dictators and communists. And it's all handwritten on this piece of card, and on the back she's written a note. It says, there is no end to the list of suspected conspirators to President Kennedy's murder. Many factions had their reasons for wanting the young president dead. That fact alone illustrates how the world suffers from a congenital proclivity to violence. And this was up for auction, I think it was about 5 years ago, and it didn't even sell, you know? I think it just went under everyone's radar. And I came across this, and I came across the Johnny Cash one in the same sort of week, I think. And I was just completely blown away, and I just knew there was legs to this project.
Well, Johnny Cash's list, you know, it's kind of humorous. It's kind of tongue-in-cheek. He certainly doesn't sign it. But in the case of, you know, there's no artifice. There's no pretense. There's no sense of an historical legacy for any of these. Do you think that that was on the mind of any famous people? Like Woody Guthrie, his list of New Year's resolutions, it seems a little more intended for an audience.
Yeah, and to some extent, I think Johnny Cash's was, because it's quite humorous, you wouldn't, I can't see myself writing that kind of list were it just for myself. You know, right. He's clearly expecting someone to read it. But Woody Guthrie, I think, is the same. There's just a lovely mix. There's a there's a absolutely heartbreaking list written by a lady called Hilary North, who worked in the Twin Towers. But on the morning of the planes going into the Twin Towers, she didn't make it to work. And all her colleagues died when the planes hit, and she wrote this list afterwards of all the things she was going to miss about her colleagues, and it's the most heartbreaking list, and you just can't imagine what she was going through when she wrote that list. You know, it's just, I just love the fact that there's such a mixture of lists in the book, some that are intended for audiences, some that weren't, some are funny, some are sad, some are really kind of historically significant. There's kind of something for everyone.
So, Sean Usher, letters of note, lists of note, where do you go to next?
I've just finished Letters of Note 2, which will be out very soon. And I'm just starting work on my next project, which is Speeches of Note. So I've done letters, lists, speeches, and then I've got other options after that as well.
You'll have to just start a list.
Basically, yeah.
Well, Sean Usher, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
You'll find much more on Sean Usher's book, Lists of Note, an eclectic collection deserving of a wider audience, at wordmouthradio.org. Of the many lists featured in Usher's collection is the Ten Commandments of Guitar Playing by the avant-garde rocker Don Van Vliet, better known as Captain Beefheart. While Beefheart, who died in 2010, never really achieved commercial success, his influence in the music business is undeniable. Beefheart gave his Ten Commandments to a member of his rotating ensemble, the Magic Band, sometime in the late 1970s. Here are just a few excerpts. 1, listen to the birds. That's where all the music comes from. 2, your guitar is not really a guitar. Your guitar is a divining rod. Use it to find spirits in the other worlds and bring them over. 3, practice in front of a bush. Wait until the moon is out, then go outside. Eat a multi-grained bread and play your guitar to a bush. If the bush doesn't shake, eat another piece of bread. Years before he crafted his Ten Commandments of Guitar Playing, Captain Beefheart crafted his most famous album, 1969's Trout Mask Replica. The album is a wild mix of free jazz, blues, and beat poetry. In this piece, produced by Devin Strolovich, we'll hear about the making of Trout Mask Replica and learn why it was so influential.
My name is John French, and I was the drummer in the Magic Band, and also the transcriber of probably 70-80% of the music, which I also taught to the other players.
My name's Mike Barnes. I'm the author of the book Captain Beefheart.
Tom Waits, musician. Prepare yourself for a glimpse into the future. These are like recipes for curatives, ancient oils.
The black paper between a mirror breaks my heart. The moon frayed through dark velvet lightly apart. Steal softly through sunshine. Steal softly through snow.
When people hear Captain Beefheart's music for the first time, it can be quite a daunting prospect, because what you had was quite a harsh and quite a distant sound that you'd probably only heard in free jazz albums before. It was the first time, really, that you'd heard that kind of structure in rock music.
It's so unlike anything that we all consider music to be. And to dance to this, there aren't really any existing dances appropriate.
Steal softly through sunshine, steal softly through snow.
I met Don Van Vliet and the Magic Band, all the members, the same night, and I was asked to join in around October of 1966. I was in a different generation than these guys. These guys came out of the 50s, you know, with rock and roll and doo-wop music, hot rods and pachuco clothes and haircuts. You know, they were sort of the badass kind of guys. I got a girl, did it, won't it.
Ain't no town and it ain't no city. Well, you can hear his influences, which is interesting. Always, Howlin' Wolf is very present. I wore my funny for so long.
I made my shoulder so. But by the time Captain Beefheart got to Trautmaster's Replica, which was recorded in 1969, he decided to employ a different compositional process.
It starts out with Frownland, which is just total chaos.
It sounds like it's been made up on the spot, but in fact it was rigorously learnt, so the players would play the tracks the same way every time.
With musicians, a lot of the time, what they really need to do is unlearn it. For myself, the first time I heard Trautmaster, I had to stop and pause and look at what it was that I was doing that I thought was interesting, relevant, or worthwhile. I just had never encountered anything filled with so much abandon.
Now here she come walking, looking like a zoo. Hi, Ella. Hi, Ella Garoo.
It was hard to believe that it was actually conducted and designed.
I think John French deserves a lot of credit for his role in the realization of Trautmaster Replica, because without his diligent work on it, transcribing piano lines or trying to make sense of a number of tapes that Don Van Vleeten made of whistling, scat singing, I think if he hadn't been able to do that, it just could easily not have worked at all.
You're talking about people playing in different keys, different time signatures, all at the same time, and you had to figure out how to end and start each section together.
And then fly apart again. Like one of those moments in a large gathering where everyone's talking at the same time, and then all of a sudden there's a moment of silence, and you don't know, it couldn't have been predicted. Fast and bulbous. And then the talking starts again.
Fast and bulbous.
That's right, the mascara snake. Fast and bulbous.
Bulbous also tapered.
Yeah, but you've got to wait until I say.
Also, a tin teardrop.
Oh, Christ.
The circumstances under which Trautmaster Replica was rehearsed were certainly not conditions I would like to have been in myself. They were in grinding poverty and they had a very harsh work regime. Beefheart would, for instance, deprive people of sleep. He would keep them up all night.
He would have these talks. He'd call it, oh, John's got a thing, like a hang-up or a problem, and we've got to talk about this, so we'd sit down and the talks would sometimes erupt into violence. So it became a very uncomfortable and paranoid situation.
Captain Beefheart himself said about Trautmaster Replica, let it come to you, play it whilst you're washing up the dishes or doing the housework. There is a logic to it. It's just trying to get used to a sort of different musical language.
The one thing that I think Don was able to bring into the whole equation, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but he didn't know what he was doing. Captain Beefheart realized the possibilities that existed in music if you looked past the rules.
Like a bee trapped in an outhouse while a man changes a tire and a plane passes over and Jay is yammering and a skateboard comes by and hits all the cracks right on time.
And that piece on Captain Beefheart's seminal album Trout Mask Replica was produced by Devin Strolovich.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Scott Fallman is a computer scientist at Carnegie Mellon University, where the focus of his research is on artificial intelligence. Currently, he's working on SCONE, an open-source knowledge-based system.
Now, to be honest, I have no idea what that means, and the real reason that we asked Fallman to speak with us is not his impressive career in AI, but because of something he invented in 1982 that is now used about 6 billion times a day. And this thing, this will be his legacy, no matter what else he accomplishes, and will probably be the thing that the world remembers him for. So, Scott Fallman, can you tell our listeners what it is that you are credited with inventing?
Well, back in 1982, we had very crude social media in those days. Basically, you could send email to a bulletin board where everyone could read it, and it was text-only email. And we were trying to find a way to indicate sarcastic comments because, of course, there's no tone of voice in those kind of messages or anything like that. We didn't have any graphics, so we were trying to think what the marker should be for jokes. I'm only kidding. And I proposed colon minus parenthesis in a post to this local bulletin board, and that seems to have gone viral on us.
So you created the emoticon.
Well, I created the smiley face. A lot of people want to fight over what the first emoticon is. I think maybe it was the exclamation mark. But I proposed the colon minus parenthesis one way for smiling and the other way for frowning, and that seems to have been what caught fire and mutated and led to all these other things.
This was in 1982. You were 34, relatively new there at Carnegie Mellon. Did you have any idea what you had created?
No, we were having a stupid discussion about what would happen if the elevator went into free fall, and somebody said, okay, now due to these experiments, the elevator's been damaged, and somebody else got bent out of shape by that. And, so this was just something I tossed off in 10 minutes in the middle of that silly discussion. We didn't even save a copy. I thought it would, amuse the 10 or 20 people listening in, and that would be that.
Well, somebody has gone back to dig out a copy from September 19th of 1982 of your proposal of the following character sequence for joke markers. And we have the colon, the minus, and the parenthesis, the smiley face. But you never got certainly paid for this, did you?
No, that's my little gift to mankind, if you... If you think about it, if it cost people 5 cents to use this or something, then nobody would use it, or if you had to get my permission. So it had to be free. I mean, there was no way to make money from it that I could see.
But do you have any regrets at all about at least not realizing that you could monetize it, as were the terms back then, to capitalize it or control it perhaps somehow?
Well, again, at the time, I never thought it was going to last longer than a day, and then it spread through Carnegie Mellon, and I thought, oh, this is going to last a week. And I never thought that, 33 years later, this thing would have spread around the world, morphed into these things. But I used to always say I never made a dime from this, and then somebody came up and gave me a dime, so I'd have to stop saying that. So now I just say I never made $1 million from it, and I hope
you're
somebody
waiting for
tried
that.
To shut me up. Yeah.
Well, you said these things. Do you not like the contemporary emoji?
I'm not crazy about the graphical ones. There was a little challenge in trying to say something amusing with just typographical characters and make, different faces and characters and so on. And I think the graphics just kind of stomp on all that. If they make people happy, great. More power to them. Just don't send me one. The one thing I do resent is when software jumps in, and I've sent somebody a text emoticon, and the software jumps in and turns it into one of those graphical things.
Oh, right, when you do a colon. I see, right, exactly. Is there any way to prevent that? You're the computer scientist.
Yeah, well, it's one software program after another, and most of them you can disable that.
Well, Dr. Fallman, I started this conversation talking about your legacy. Does it bother you that you're going to be remembered or talked to or about the emoticon?
Well, this was 10 silly minutes of my life 34 years ago, and it's kind of weird that this is probably the most famous thing I'll ever do, even if I make major inroads into the study of artificial intelligence. However, it's kind of fun to be something, to be a little bit famous for something. And it's been a fun ride. I've been invited to places to give talks on this, and some of them have been fun places. I've met a lot of people. If I'm going to be remembered for something completely trivial, at least it's a happy something trivial.
Well, it does seem like history remembers a good story. So is the creation of the smiley face just a better story or maybe easier story to tell than that of your work in artificial intelligence?
Yeah, it takes me a little while to explain what I'm doing in AI, and it depends on the educational level of who's listening and, you know, how much they know about computers to begin with.
Okay, so assume that I'm a third grader in science. What would you like to tell me about SCONE, the program that you are working on?
Well, what I've been doing pretty much my whole career is trying to get some kind of common sense into these systems. So they're AI systems that do impressive things, but they're mostly things people go away to college to learn, you know, chess and solving complex linear equations and nonlinear equations and solving chemistry problems and so on. But we still don't have intelligent programs that know what a table and a chair is and that you sit on one and you're supposed to, you know, put stuff on the other, maybe eat from it. That it's a good idea to open a door before you go through it, which we have to tell the robots. So what all people have by the time they're, you know, 5 years old or certainly 10 is this huge store of knowledge about the world. You know, different jobs, different kinds of people. What are the rules for talking to your elders? And that differs from one culture to another, which you learn later. So there's, when we say common sense, it's really all the knowledge we have in common. But you can't just plug in Wikipedia to an AI system and have that be good enough, because the knowledge has to get into the game. It has to play a role in all your thinking, and it has to be accessible to you when it's needed and not get in your face the rest of the time.
You spend a
so
lot.
So I'm trying to build a system that will support that and people can use and put into their various AI programs or even not AI programs and make them more sensible, easier to deal with. And we're trying to get them to understand natural language, you know, simple English.
You've been working at this for a long time. Do you think you'll see that, realize it in your lifetime?
Well, it depends on my funding, but yeah.
Well, I actually read something about your funding, that it's about to expire. Now, what does that mean and
what
that
well,
is next?
The current grant we're on is about to expire, and we're talking with those folks about maybe the next grant. But it depends if the government gets shut down and all of those things. This is mostly federal research money.
Don't they know who you are?
Well, there are a lot of smart people working in this field, and right now this is not the most fashionable kind of research. Everybody's working on machine learning and big data, you may have heard about. The kind of AI I'm working on is just what people can do, you know. A lot of the field is off doing all these things that no human can actually do, and I'm trying to get the stuff that every normal person just does without even thinking about it.
You said earlier it's nice to be a little bit famous. Is it better then to be in the history books for something you're not entirely proud of or take complete ownership of than to be left out of them entirely?
Well, it's my goal to be in the history book for something else also, you know, which is why I'm still working at this. I'd like to make some real inroads into artificial intelligence and make some lasting difference in the field. I've done some things that are, you know, of some value to the field, but I think what I'm working on now is maybe the big home run.
To that I say, colon, minus, parentheses.
which kind of parenthesis?
The parenthesis that looks happy.
Okay, that's good.
Dr. Scott Fahlman, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Right, thank you.
Scott Fahlman, he's a research professor at Carnegie Mellon University and inventor of that little smiley face that became the emoji. You can read a portrait of him from Narratively. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. Even the dreamiest of inventors may not imagine how influential their creations will become. Roman Mars of the podcast 99% Invisible brings us the story of a man whose invention spread far beyond the grocery stores it was designed for.
This sound is unmistakable.
Maybe you find it kind of lulling, like I do, since it signifies the end of a trip to the grocery store.
That's our new producer, Katie Mingle. I myself find that sound a bit anxiety-inducing, since it's also the sound of the total that I'm going to have to pay going up and up and up.
when I go to the grocery store and check out, I don't tell the checkout people. My wife always did. Yeah, my husband here is the one that invented that barcode. And they just kind of look at you as if to say, you mean there was a time they didn't have a barcode?
It's hard to imagine now, a world without barcodes. A world without George Lohrer.
Well, hello. I'm George J. Lohrer. I'm the one that invented the UPC barcode and symbol in 1973.
Now, some of you might be saying to yourselves, I thought Joseph Woodland invented the barcode.
And if you're saying that to yourself, you are a nerd, and I love you for it. And just hold your nerd horses, because we're getting to Woodland right now.
In 1948, Joseph Woodland was trying to come up with a symbol that, when scanned, would translate to a number that a computer could use to identify a product. This would move people more quickly through the checkout line, which was a place where grocery stores felt they were losing money. So one day, the legend goes, Woodland's sitting on the beach drawing circles in the sand and thinking about Morse code. Instead of dot, 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 dash, 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 he thinks, I can use skinny and wide lines.
Bullseye.
Bullseye. The very first barcodes were in the shape of a bullseye.
That was 1948. And then for about 20 years, the bullseye idea gathered dust. The scanners and other equipment needed to put the system in place were just too expensive for any of it to be feasible.
Fast forward to 1973. The technology is now a bit more affordable, and a group of supermarket executives are like, okay, barcode or bust, we're doing this. So they put together a list of qualities that their ideal barcode would have and asked 14 different companies to come up with a proposal.
Could be no larger than 1.5 square inches, had to be omnidirectional.
That's George Lohrer again. He was working at IBM at the time, which was one of the companies competing to make the best barcode. And he looked long and hard at Woodland's design and didn't think it would work.
I couldn't support that as the solution to what the grocery industry wanted, because to me, there was no way that it would fulfill their specifications. My integrity just would not let me come up with a bunch of bull.
So George went back to the drawing table.
My wife said I came back and I would work on it day and night. Most of us was thinking, arithmetic, trying to prove that this would work. Also, I have to admit, I had to disprove that some of the others wouldn't work.
He ultimately came up with a rectangular barcode that fit more code into less space. Even Joe Woodland thought George's rectangular barcode was better.
Joe Woodland was very enthusiastic. He worked with me. In fact, he wrote the actual proposal for the submission to the grocery industry.
The symbol selection committee unanimously voted for George Lohrer's rectangular symbol and code. They called it the Universal Product Code, or UPC. And a year later, in 1974, a pack of Wrigley's chewing gum became the first item to ever be scanned with the UPC barcode.
When barcodes became the standard, they didn't just make checkout lines faster. They allowed stores to keep track of huge amounts of inventory and to collect data on what we were buying.
It's estimated that there are now around 5 billion UPC barcodes scanned every day around the world.
We thought it would stay just within the grocery industry. We had no idea how far it was going to go.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
I was just about to check the contents of the stomach anyway. Something's embedded in the stomach lining. Looks like a microchip.
May I see that for a second?
A clip there from NCIS New Orleans, one of several crime procedurals that have made death, gore, and gristle common on television. With their spunky pathologists and well-lit labs, these shows reduce the emotional freight of death to just blood, bone, and tissue. What they don't do is prepare even seasoned viewers for the shock of facing real corpses during a real autopsy. Rachel Wilkinson attended an autopsy at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and wrote about it for The Atlantic. And Rachel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How did you end up in an autopsy room at UPMC?
Well, I was actually in a medical writing class. It was not easy. I didn't start out, in other words, sort of planning to go to an autopsy, but I met the full-time hospital pathologist at UPMC, Dr. Jeffrey Nine. I met him, and within the span of about 5 minutes, he said really reverent, beautiful things about his job, and then at the same time sort of made a really funny joke. And I thought, okay, there's something weird going on in this room where they're navigating between the sacred and the profane, and I knew I wanted to get in and see it. So I did sort of a dry run where I saw the room and there was nobody there, and then I went when they didn't have a case, and then they got me in to see an actual case.
So that's a teaching hospital, correct?
Correct.
How often do they conduct autopsies at UPMC?
Because it's not like NCIS, so it's not homicides. It's whenever someone has a relative die in the system and the next of kin elects to have that autopsy performed. So it comes out to about one a day, a little less, or about 350 a year.
Well, they are part of the formula on many police and crime shows. So what are some of the ways that autopsies as seen on TV differ from the real thing?
A forensic autopsy, you're trying very hard to sort of look at it from a legal perspective, and it usually has to be done quickly, and you're trying to get information out, sometimes to lawyers, to other doctors, whoever. Whereas hospital autopsy, they assume the cause isn't homicide, and so in a big teaching hospital like UPMC, they take a lot more time. Mm-hmm. So on NCIS, they can do 40 minutes an hour per autopsy, and you're going to have multiple bodies per day coming in. But the one a day of just sort of natural causes in the hospital system, they can take their time. And because it's students working, they can take up to 6 hours to do that.
Wow. Were you the only person there attending for the first time?
Yes.
So students are usually, they're pretty well seasoned in this. Did you get any warning or tips for how to prepare?
I was told it's totally acceptable to faint, and that trained professionals, medical students, everybody faints. And so to be prepared for whatever natural reaction my body was going to have. And some of the really new people, they told me the smell is sometimes the hardest part. So they will wear like Vaseline under their noses. I said, no, I'm going to do it all in, all natural. And it wasn't as bad as I thought.
And you didn't faint.
Didn't faint.
Did you know anything about the identity of the person that you were witnessing the autopsy on?
Because of privacy reasons, they kind of wanted to hide his identity as much as possible. So basically all I knew was his general age range, his time of death, and what they thought the cause of death would be. But other than that, I didn't know his family, his job, where he was from, any of that.
Now, they put, something over, a sheet or something to cover his face during the autopsy. Do they normally do that, or was that just for your purposes?
You know, I was thinking about that, actually. I think it was in deference to me, but I don't know if they suddenly realized like, oh, there's this visitor in the room and maybe we should defer to her, or if it maybe is something they do in some cases. It was such a lovely moment that I kind of didn't ask at the time.
A lovely moment. What do you mean?
The interesting thing, I think, is when you step into the room, everything is immediately routinized. It's hard in some ways to have an emotional reaction because everybody is at work doing their jobs, running around, and so everything is kind of scientific and accounted and present for. But then there are these little moments where you realize, oh, like, here's what we're actually doing. And so they were very much in the middle of just procedure and talking and teaching, and it all seemed, in this strange way, very ordinary and banal. And then suddenly we're called back into the reality of, oh, this is a person. This is a dead body in the room with a face. Mm. And so when they did that, it was this really nice act. I felt that paid homage to where we were. And then immediately after that, we were kind of back in the investigation part of it. And the oscillation between those two things is what I found so fascinating.
Many of us have witnessed autopsies in quotes on programs like NCIS or other crime procedurals. Well, I'm speaking with Rachel Wilkinson, who attended one for real at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and wrote about it for The Atlantic magazine. Well, your description of Dr. Jeffrey Nine, he's the pathologist that was conducting the autopsy you attended. I don't know, it almost made him sound like one of those TV characters, you know, throwing out really good one-liners 1 minute and then expert analysis the next. What was he like as a guide?
He was exactly like that. Extremely competent, and could jump in and do anything, and yet he clearly was trying to keep it, you know, it seems almost crass to say, like, fun and light for the students, but there was an element of that. And then a fun fact about him that did not make it into the article is he is also a seminarian.
Really?
He is, I think, a Presbyterian minister on the weekends. And so another pathology stereotype is that they're kind of low on emotional intelligence, but he's actually known for being incredibly empathetic and communicative with families. So he can wear so many hats. And so he's, needless to say, really fantastic at his job and navigating all those different things.
Well, pathologists also have a rap, I think, for being, you know, a little bit creepy. You know, somehow their work is macabre or kept underground. What did you learn about their work?
I mean, I think I came to sympathize with them that I had no idea what a pathologist was beforehand, and then came to realize how essential they are to the medical profession and also how hidden. Because it is true that if the person biopsying a cancer sample and telling you whether it's cancer or not is them, just behind the scenes, who you may or may not talk to. So I came to appreciate that they're incredibly knowledgeable and they have to know everything, and yet we don't see them as much as we maybe could.
An autopsy is like the best anatomy lesson one could ever attend. Did it change the way that you understand the human body?
You know, it's strange. It kind of did. By the end of this, and I was not expecting this at all, I mean, I was holding organs. But it's strange to see a liver on the table, because now whenever I like have a drink or something, I can imagine myself so much more clearly as an embodied person who's finite, you know, who has like an end date. And they all told me this too, that the cliche is true, that they all feel more connected to life by virtue of the fact that they see death all the time.
Do autopsies just become run of the mill?
They do, because it's your day in, day out job and you have, you know, a script that you follow. But at the same time, there are these moments that they never really completely get past where you realize this is a person on the table and I'm confronting my own mortality. I kind of got them to speak about what brings them back to that sacred place. And they said it's things like when a body comes on the table and it has fingernail polish or a tattoo. And so those little tiny personal things are the things that kind of bring them out of this scientific space and back into the space of life.
It's so interesting. Is it an experience that you'd recommend to anyone else if they have the chance to witness an autopsy?
It's strange to say that I would, because it did change me in a way. And I do like think about it from time to time. We live in a culture now where death, talking about death, you know, any of the ugliness of death is particularly taboo and hidden. Even 100 years ago here in downtown Pittsburgh, where the morgue used to be, they used to have a plate glass window where they display bodies on the slab. And it was for people to ID victims. That was the stated purpose. But allegedly, people would like come by with their prom dates to look at the bodies.
Wowie.
Yeah, and this was true in pretty much all major cities, you know, at the end of the 19th century. Like the Paris morgue was also infamous for this. And so it's really been stripped away from the public space like that. And so they feel privileged to be kind of close to that because it's something that is locked away now. And they're sort of almost the last keeper of it. And so to get to sit in on that when it's something that we just, I mean, I guess we do on NCIS, but in a sort of not fictionalized way, interact with it. It was a privilege to get to see that along with them.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for sharing that experience with us.
Oh, thank you.
Rachel Wilkinson, she's a Pittsburgh-based writer who wrote about attending an autopsy for The Atlantic. You can find a link to read the article at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for taking some time with us on the precious summer weekend. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And you'll never miss a beat if you subscribe to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, we encourage you to write a review or tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.